Matt Barr. I work for a company called Mosquito Mole Multiworks, my little consulting company. Helped write a book called The Rails Way with Toby Fernandez. It's a fantastic book. Probably the best Rails book out there. You need to buy it. Last week I was in New York. I signed a deal for another book. Definitely need to buy that one too. It's about Ruby and data processing, data visualization. It's quite good. I mentioned I was in New York. That's where I do all my work. I don't really do too much work here in the Midwest, but most of my contracts, most of my gigs are all based out of New York. But I do work from here. I telecommute, actually in St. Paul. I like it better that way. But I do travel to New York quite a bit. Every 4 weeks, 5 weeks right now. Works out pretty nice. Spend a lot of time on the phone. And in New York, I work for a very large company, an enterprise, you might say. Which is probably different than what most people think of and associate with Rails. But doing this enterprise and company I've worked for, well, obviously blank, for the past 6 months, the challenge has been to shift over the J2E environment to Ruby on Rails. My job is to make that happen. They have a couple of different components. They have their in-house talent, and they have a lot of offshoring as well, outsourcing to India. And so my job has been trying to switch over both internal and external groups over to Ruby on Rails. And this hasn't been working. So today I'll talk about why do enterprises go up to outsourcing? They know it doesn't work, so why do they do it? How outsourcing fails them? Why we can farm sourcing better? By that I mean doing the jobs here locally in Minnesota. And how Ruby on Rails really changes this whole equation. And why I'm hiring at this point. But I just really call it, how I stopped worrying about the enterprise and started to love it. Now, like I mentioned, most enterprises kind of know the problems and difficulties with outsourcing stuff. But they often do it because they're in a hard spot, right? They have kind of out on an edge. They don't have anywhere to go. Oftentimes, they have a huge backlog of projects, right? They have all this stuff that's going on. The list just keeps adding. Business keeps moving forward. They still can't get the last release out, on and on. And they have this backlog, and they have tons of users. The company I work for right now, international, I think they have offices in every damn country. Number of users on projects are probably like, I think last one was like 20,000 people on this thing. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So you have this big backlog of projects. You have all these users coming up with new ideas, new requirements. You can't find good talent at all because a lot of the times they don't want to work in a corporate culture, and especially when you have to deal with companies that are offering perks like free food, flexible hours, the ability to work from home, or the option to get rich, in stock options. It doesn't happen, but, people still have that pipe dream. So in the end, you have this backlog, all this stuff is going on, and what really adds up to is some really pissed off users. And so this is, every enterprise I go to, I typically find just users that are just irate, upset. And why is that? Well, they go home and they use Facebook, right? So they come to the office and like, why doesn't my intranet work like Facebook? Why can't I message people at my company like I do with Twitter? And companies and IT managers and CIOs are going mad, and what they're looking for is some kind of escape out, right? Some way to solve this problem. They know they have developers and they can hire people and make this happen. It's not that the developers are incompetent, although there is a good percentage of them in enterprises that are incompetent. But oftentimes, the fact is that they're really busy doing stuff. They have all these legacy applications. They didn't get the budget they needed. They had someone that was bad, they're just really quite busy trying to make this happen. So what do? They go to the map and they find a place where they can send the work. They send to India or, Russia or somewhere else. There's different places, but I'll talk about India. That's where I have most of my experience doing. And the idea for them to outsource is to get that gun pointed away from their head. The idea is let's work this backlog of projects that we have, make this backlog go away, and let's do it in such a way that we can still meet the fiscal constraints that we have. Those are the two requirements. Notice I didn't mention anything about quality, right? This all goes back to this idea that you control three, there's three things. You can do time, quality, and cost. When you outsource, oftentimes you only have control over the time and the cost. So what does that leave? That means whoever you're outsourcing with is now responsible for quality. And so then quality usually drops because the other two components are more important or they're more fixed. I think this is the real failure that I see with the companies that I've outsourced with. They're some of the better outsourcing firms, actually. But I think the real failure is they don't realize that their responsibility is for quality, right? The client that hires them is responsible for figuring out, negotiate the time, you negotiate the cost. But then whatever is left over, those outsourcing companies really need to focus on the quality, doing some ways to increase that quality given those constraints. And I just don't see any focus on that. Of course, there's other problems with outsourcing besides just quality, right? There's a whole language problem. There's an issue with time zones. They use old technology. The problem with old technology is if you use old technology, what are you going to produce? You're going to produce stuff that's like old technology. The other big problem is, right, saying no. I swear to God that if I tell them to put blink on the website, the whole homepage will blink. There's just not this idea of, saying no to the client, like there might be something better. It goes two ways with outsourcing. You don't necessarily want to outsource something and have them come back next day like, we said no, we just didn't tell you and we changed it all. So there's a balance. The other big problem is a lack of talent. Sorry, you might think differently. I don't think there's any talent here. Specifically, do you know, 1 in 10 resumes that, the two firms, actually this is ThoughtWorks told me this number. 1 in 10 resumes that they get is actually legit. So, the other 9 resumes have all been faked or forged or something like that. This is ThoughtWorks, they actually do it. Check. Tata or something like that. It doesn't always do the checks. The other problem with outsourcing too is, have you ever heard of RailsConf India or, Demo India or anything like that? There's not this idea of this larger community, this conference, and pushing ideas forward. It's much more this manufacturing concept. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And the other problem that I've been facing a lot with is mentoring. There's just no mentors. If you ask them if they have a question, where do they go for the answer? They go to their manager, but there's not this idea of, this guy's really studied the code, understands the language, or makes this happen. So there's not this mentoring. So as a result, there's just this kind of constant, normalized level that everyone's at. There's not this pushing forward. The other thing too is, going back to kind of old technology, there's not very few Web 2.0 or web startup companies in India right now. There are a few that come up, but there isn't a whole lot. And I think the problem with that is they're not thinking about business and on their own. They're probably not thinking about your business, your bottom line, and what you have as well, because that's what you bring to business. And there's also this kind of lack of testing. Now, I'll caution this because outsourcing testing does work, pretty well. But actually, as far as like software development and the testing that goes along with it, we mandate testing on all the code that we get back. But a lot of times I get tested back that's testing that 1 + 1 = 2 true, or that true is not equal to false. Just testing the framework, not necessarily the code. And so like I said, I think the real failure of outsourcing right now to India or other places is just this lack of focus on quality. And so the firms that we try to hire, I always ask these kind of questions, what languages are you learning? When you have a problem, who do you ask? Who do they ask? How do you test some bad coding practices? And every time I ask these questions, the answers I get just shock me. And so this has been bugging me for a long time, why doesn't this idea and these concepts get across to other people when I sort of groups I'm outsourcing with? And when I was moving my office, I saw this book again, and it made complete sense. I think the problem is that it's a manufacturing versus craftsmanship kind of problem. When you send code or send stuff out to outsource, it's being manufactured. Your software is being manufactured on some big assembly line. And the idea is that the more bodies that you throw at it, the faster it'll get done and coded. And you'll save costs by, cutting corners. But it's different here in the Midwest, right? There isn't this focus of manufacturing software. This whole idea that software is crafted and it's forged. Takes a lot of skill and stuff. I mean, we can see that, right? Cray doesn't manufacture compilers, right? They craft them. And same thing with Dow Jones, right? They don't manufacture their servers and trading systems. They're all crafted because there's this real focus of quality here. There's also some other benefits, here versus India, obviously. Or here versus other parts of the States, actually. We have a very low cost of living here as well, relative to where I'm working, which is either New York or on the West Coast. For example, I stay at the Waldorf because my client is ridiculously expensive. They have more money than they know what to do with. But when I stay there, right, I stay in like this one room suite, or this one room with a king bed, nothing special, $400 a night about. Here, I can, $400, I can stay at the St. Paul Hotel. I can get a junior two-room suite with like a full refrigerator and everything else. The point is, the Midwest can actually compete a lot of times on a very cost basis by still keeping that quality. So something that's comparing the Midwest here to New York. But if we compare the Midwest, say, to India, for example, on the prices, this is what you find out. So right now, if I consult and outsource, right now I pay like $25 an hour to like Tata or TCS for on the low end for, you know, having code developed. And these are some, they're better guys because I'm teaching them Rails and Ruby on Rails, and so they're doing the best quality guys, which are not quality at all. On the high end, I could pay ThoughtWorks, right? ThoughtWorks India cost me $50 an hour. And this stuff ship code. Now, Minneapolis here, I can go and hire, you know, college grads or things like that, kind of just out of school. So they're not really, you know, they're barely functional is how I refer to them, because they have the concepts, but they don't know how to implement anything. At a much, you know, lower cost. In India, I get some guy with 2 years experience. And that's 2 years complete experience. I mean, that's 2 years since, like, they had their first job. A new college grad has been at least coding something in school for 4 years. You know, granted, it might have been Scheme or something, but at least he was coding. So, I mean, sorry, Scheme is cool. I just don't use it too much. And then there's also this other concept of, you know, this mentality of software development is manufacturing that's kind of taught over there versus here, where it's kind of crafted. It's a skill. It takes time. So there is obviously a price difference, right? But there are some soft costs that change that whole like equation, right? So some of the soft costs that make outsourcing more expensive, time zones. It's not so much about how much time you have overlap, it's how much time you don't have overlap, because that's the amount of time shit could hit the fan and go off course. So India, I have like, I think about 2 hours overlap, which means there's 22 hours for things to go off course. That's a big problem. Obviously, working here is a little bit easier communication-wise. In fact, you can even go and see the client easily. By far the best thing about, you know, outsourcing or farm sourcing here in the Midwest is Sun Country. That is like God saving the airline. I can, for the same price, if there's a big enough problem, I can just book a flight that day and maybe get on it yet. And it's the same low cost, low price. I mean, the ability for me to get on a plane and get to a client that quickly is huge, absolutely huge. And the amount of confidence that instills in a client is just phenomenal. You do that like once or twice and that client just won't go anywhere else. And we do have talent here, right? Picture of Mini Bar last year, or Mini Demo, actually. There's plenty of talent here in the Midwest. I mean, just right here in the metro area that goes on tap. Additionally, we use new technology, right? Granted, we're not maybe as new as the West Coast and Silicon Valley, but we at least can talk about what Twitter is, how it works, and kind of what some of the designs are, which means when things that we build going forward also are built on top of that new technology. And we have user groups like Rum and conferences like Mini Bar. So all those things help, you know, give this community all differentiators versus outsourcing. This whole idea that we're actually crafting software, take skill, we have to pass this knowledge on, it's more of a trade. I also find there's about twice as much productivity. We use Scrum where I'm at, right? So we always have velocities and things like that. And if I compare the velocities that I get out of my guys in New York versus what I get out of offshoring, it's about twice as productive here locally for the guys in New York. There's nothing special about the guys in New York compared to the guys here, so I would expect if I was, you know, having the guys here do it locally, I get the same twice as productive. So if you compare as a soft cost into the whole equation, you know, India doesn't like come out too far ahead. Now granted, I'm not paying some guys by like anyone here in this room. So I'm looking the, you know, the dollars that I'm talking about are guys that are straight out of college, guys that are barely functional. I'll talk more about that. But if I take a new college grad, here I get, you know, college grads, I've been coding, they have the concepts, the fundamentals. They think about software as craftsmanship. There's this focus on quality. There's a large talent pool for me to pull from. I think about the number of universities that we have. And there's a large community to help push them along onto the next step and get better and better. And to me, I'm seeing twice as productive. And I'll talk more about why that productivity exists. But all in all, these qualities here, or, you know, be Minneapolis or just be the Midwest, is why I call this thing called farm sourcing, and why I've been selling this concept of farm sourcing to Fortune 500 companies in New York lately. And they've been interested. We still have an experiment ready to run, but they're interested. And what they're interested in is this. You know, instead of having quality be this low thing, they're seeing higher quality at the same kind of time and cost functionalities. And if anything, it's time actually shrinks too by arm sourcing it. And so this gets him quite excited about this idea that, well, we'll just send here locally instead of outsourcing it, locally being in the Midwest. But this only works, I should talk about, the idea of the slide is to tell you how farm sourcing works. It takes a couple different components. The way I do it is, I find some talent, I pay them very little. That's important. Competing with people, I get paid a little. I mentor them for 1 or 2 years, and then I kick them out and find them a better job somewhere else. So all my talent pool, this is like 1 or 2 year turnover. Everyone's gone after 1 or 2 years. And I'll tell you, explain why that is. There's obviously some serious problems with this concept that need to be addressed. First of all, is a talent pool, right? I'm hiring guys like this. They're barely functional. Like, they barely function, past 10 o'clock in the morning. It's easy, though, to find them, right? I can find them here. I might have this guy hired. I'm not sure. I think his name's Jim. There's this University of St. Thomas, Metro State, McAllister, it goes on and on, right? I call them barely functional. I'm not making fun of the fact that they got a college education in CS. I mean, not at all. But the point is, they understand all the concepts. They don't necessarily understand the implementation of how to do it. And that's actually where I'm better. I don't have a CS degree, right? So I can't speak knowledgeable about, differences between, like Robert Fisher could talk about. So, I mean, I can't compete with that. But what I can compete on is I know how to implement this stuff fast, quickly, high quality, and run it and meet the business needs. And that's where my value comes in. So that's also talent pool, right? I'll just hire a bunch of college kids. And the wages problem is different, right? So, I pay somewhere between 40 and 60 for a new guy. I don't, obviously there's some guys on my team that are not new and they get paid quite well for that because I always need quality people for the mentoring. But I pay much closer to the $40 an hour. And so the question is, why the hell would someone work so little for so little when they could just jump on a plane, go to the West Coast and get a better paying job or something like that and make, $60 or $70 or easily more than that? But my question back is, why would someone pay to go to grad school, right? Because that's what I'm offering. I'm telling these college kids, come work for me, I'll be your grad school. Get the cheapest damn grad school you've ever had in your life because I'm actually writing you a check. You give me 1 to 2 years, which is faster than you can get in grad school, and I'll pay you a decent wage, I'll mentor you, and everything from new technologies, from different version control systems, to continuous integration, behavioral driven development, test driven development, I'll teach you project management, I'll tell you how to contract. I'll teach you everything in that time. And just give me those 2 years, right? In which I'm paying you a lower rate than you could get somewhere else. But at the end of the 2 years, I'm going to go out and get you a better job, and you're going to go off somewhere else and get twice the pay and be way ahead than everyone else. So you got to look, get out there quite as fast, but when you do get out there, you're going to be a killer because you have all these qualities, and if you want to go out on your own and hang your own shingle, you'll be in a perfect state to do that. And I think this is how I'm going to draw enough people to do this, to farm source and keep my turnover going. The truth is, after 2 years, they're not going to be wanting to do the work, right? Because I'm targeting Fortune 500 companies, internal apps, things like that. This is not sexy work, right? This is not the stuff that will get you on the page of TechCrunch or GitHub. But it will, get you the skills and the training that you need so when you make that next hop. For me, running this company, it's fantastic too because these people might switch to, the people that contracted with us to do the building of this application, they can go work for those Fortune 500 companies, and now I've got implanted salesmen and women, which is fantastic. There's another problem too, right? So if I got these barely functional college kids, I got to be able to mentor them fast, and not just like 1 or 2 people, right? Because mentoring 1 or 2 people is pretty simple. I sit down next to you. What I need to do is mentor on a much larger scale. I mean, a scale like a team of 30, 40 people, right? If not larger, how do you do that? Well, I'm not going to tell you how because that's kind of my secret and how this whole thing works. I kind of want to keep my business. But I will tell you that there's 3 components. If you think hard about it, it's probably not too difficult to replicate. Obviously, the first one you all know, you have to have some good mentoring, right? You're going to have this team of barely functional college kids, right? They're not going to know what to do. They're going to look to somebody, right? So whoever is your mentor, you better be really comfortable with and happy with that, because you're going to get like 30 replicas of that guy that you hire. So if you don't like him, you're not going to like him 30 times over in about, you know, 6 or 8 months. So having that seed person that dictates, you know, how things are going to go and how it's going to happen is quite important. So mentoring is very important. The next part is tools, right? Because you're going to have only so many mentors and so many people, so you're going to have tools. And this is, I think, kind of where our specialty is. We have some good tools that we're building and have built to be able to properly mentor all these people on a much larger scale, get them up to speed much quicker, and get them much more productive faster. And that's, you know, the tools, I think, are a big thing, because I can take that one mentor and just amplify them across the team. Actually, right now, where I work, I built these tools and to amplify and to make it, you know, make myself, because I'm supposed to be mentoring these offshore teams. And these tools are working with that group in India, so I can now imagine what they're going to work like when it's actually close to them as other communication that would happen. And the third secret is really no secret, but you might not expect it. It's Ruby on Rails. But this last one I can talk about, not so much the tools that we use. Ruby on Rails is fantastic for this whole taking someone that's barely functional, getting them up to speed, and keeping costs down, and making the timeline faster. Some of you might already know this. But the nice thing is, the U is not teaching Ruby on Rails, McAllister. I mean, the only one that I could even guess that would be teaching Ruby on Rails would be Metro State, because they kind of get it faster than most. But the nice thing about Ruby is, I can teach someone Ruby, the language, and they can be kind of writing programs in probably 1 or 2 days. Try that with another language, like C++, C#. You know, Java, you might get somewhat functional too. But Ruby is so easy to understand and be, you know, somewhat productive right away. Obviously, you're not going to know all the details, but it'd be good enough. So that's a huge benefit, because the whole idea is I need to take really functional people, get them up to some competent level so I can start monetizing them, you know, and start contracting them out. So whatever language I can use to make that happen or framework, that's great. And Ruby on Rails does that because it makes it very easy for me to teach. The other nice thing about Ruby on Rails is highly opinionated. Now this is actually a really big benefit for which I didn't understand why this would be such a good thing. I mean, I liked it as a developer because it made me think less and made me do less. But when I started teaching Ruby on Rails and trying to figure out where people were being stuck, I realized that the opinionated nature of Ruby on Rails was fantastic, because it was like a warning light, right? If I get some new guys working on some code, and all of a sudden I can see that they're frustrated or having a hard time or not producing, it's kind of like a warning light that something's not right. So what I tell most people is, if it's hard, probably not doing it right, because Ruby on Rails is pretty darn simple. Unless you're doing, like, you know, integration with stuff or advanced agent. But for something that should just kind of work and it's frustrating, it should be a warning light to you, and you should go and seek your mentor and just ask, why is this not working, or is there a better way? And that's worked out really well, because a lot of times people don't know when to ask the question or when they know that they're too far along down the wrong path. So Ruby on Rails has been fantastic for that. The other nice thing about Ruby on Rails is it's like the IKEA, right? I mean, if you look at the API and the framework for Ruby on Rails, everything is in there. I mean, about like 80 or 90% of it. What's nice about that is as soon as something happens or as soon as there's some project, I can either put a plugin in, I can go grab some code from the helpers, I can do, you know, an association proxy from Active Record. All this stuff is already written, which is nice, because then I can take those people that, you know, those new college students that are still learning, they can start being productive right away, because most of the code is already written for them, already tested, and they can, like I said, be productive right away. Another nice thing too is it keeps the cost down too, because we don't have to write that code. And the nice thing about not having to write the code, because it already exists in Rails, is, I mean, statistically there should be less bugs, right? Because statistically there's less lines of code written by the group, which is really nice. So, you know, the fact that there's so much built into Ruby on Rails is, keeps the bug count low, I think. The other thing, too, is since there's so much built into Ruby on Rails, we can develop much faster. Now, this is actually where, like I mentioned, that I typically see a twice as much productivity, with the guys in New York versus outsourcing. And I think this is because the guys in New York better understand the API. And they know what tools to use, or not tools, but what methods, what functions, and things like that to call. So they're much more productive right away. And what I've actually seen that has made outsourcing and made my current employer really rethink the whole outsourcing thing has been Ruby on Rails. So when you outsource a project, you know, like I said, there's not much time overlap, and as a result, there's a lot of front-end loading about figuring out what the requirements are, figuring out what the design, how things should work, all this upfront cost, which makes sense if change is so expensive later on. But Ruby on Rails kind of changes that equation. It's not just Ruby. I think you can get it to Django and Groovy and a few other things. But Ruby on Rails, I think, does really well. And the fact is, the cost of change is so low later on that if you front-end load it with so much requirements and design and all this upfront stuff, you just basically waste your money because the cost of change was so little and you could have just built it. Then that's not quite right. Change directions and keep on going. You don't get that necessarily when you outsource it, especially across so many time zones, because, you know, there's not this nice feedback loop that's always happening, this thing, which is really great about a lot of the interpreted languages that we have nowadays. So, and then in the other problem too is that front-end development and management and all that stuff is happening at much more expensive salaries, right? So you don't see that in the $25 an hour that you would say for outsourcing it, but you do see that in the expense you have to pay for your PM, your business analyst, maybe you have an architect or something like that design. Those costs all still exist, and those are high-cost jobs to do something later on that, you know, is very cheap. So when you take the total cost of the operation, it becomes, doesn't become quite as cost-effective to outsource. The other nice thing about Ruby on Rails is because there is so much code, and the code is so, you know, easy to read, provides a nice reference for these new people if they have to implement new functionality, like a new handler or a new helper or something like that, to look back and reference and see, well, this is how I did it before, and, or how they did it, so this is probably how I should do it as well. The other nice thing about Ruby on Rails that I think really changes this thing and makes this, you guys don't know what that is, right? It's amazing when I saw it, like, brought back so many memories. Not all good ones either. This is a great thing about Ruby on Rails, right? It's got built-in testing, which is really good when you got guys like this writing your code. This is just, you know, mandatory to have. Now I can feel somewhat confident that, you know, these college kids that are writing my code, writing the code for these Fortune 500 companies, are actually producing code that still functions, still works, and they can see it. The nice thing too is with this, I can give the status back to, you know, the PMs or project managers. They can always see where the project is at. So that built-in testing capability and the idea that's in there right now is really great. I guess I forgot to mention one other benefit of hiring college kids. They haven't really learned bad habits yet, which is kind of, you know, I'd rather have that than try to break someone's bad habits. I mean, I have some bad coding habits and I can't break myself of doing them a lot of times. But you get college kids, there's someone coming in, they don't have those necessarily. They can just put it on the right path. The fact that Rails has built-in testing, they get this test infection, you know, from the get-go, which is really good. More universities need to teach test infection.
So you have projects that last over a period of years, and if you're...
Like they go well, no, they don't last over a period of years. I mean, there'll be maintenance of them over a period of years.
Right. I'm curious about if you need to, how you cope with this turnover. If your recent grads are only in there for 1 or 2 years, and it sounds like you'd have 100% team turnover in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine you'd have to figure something out to help that knowledge transfer along.
Yeah.
So anything besides the opinionation of Rails that you find you have to do?
I think one is we have decent test cases that we also write, so we can actually see what the intention of something is. Most of the apps that we do are kind of implement. So like right now, what we're building is either like the typically wikis of some variation, some document management type of some system, or like a little social site or something like that. So most of the apps are pretty kind of standard CRUD design apps of uploading files, fetch data, present it, modify it, send it back. The only time that it gets a little bit tricky is when we have to integrate with other systems, because then there is some special knowledge that's going on there. But then usually the test cases or provide us with enough. But yeah, there is that turnover, so then all of a sudden you have to go back to an old project. A lot of times we're kind of learning it to do. But the other thing too is we try to keep, you know, I'm talking about the new students turnover 1 to 2 years, but there's still a core group of people in the company that still persists beyond that to keep going. Obviously they turn over as well, but you want that at a slower rate.
What's the average length of your projects?
What's that?
What's the average length of your projects? What do you target for?
We try to do them like, I mean, ideally the shorter the better. So, you know, 6 months I think would be an ideal amount that we're going to shoot for. And if they're bigger than that, we'll phase them out. So then they're all separate.
And average team size?
Actually, that's kind of interesting. My average team size in India, right? So like if my project I sent to ThoughtWorks, I think there's 10 of them working on it. Team size that I sent to Tata is probably twice that. For that same size team, it's usually here locally, like two guys in New York. Or, you know, if it's a bigger one, there might be four or five on it total. So, yeah.
So you're grabbing people pulling from the Midwest and drawing them into New York City, theory?
College kids in New York City, hell no. I mean, you see that Spencer Ford's going to say cookers and blow. No, I mean, we do send, the idea is, yeah, we will send them to get work with the customer and the client. They're not incapable. It's just fun to make fun. It's kind of fun to make fun of them.
Do you have any experience with Eastern Europeans compared to Indians? Why do people there, like, their presence, do you have any experience with?
Actually, you know what? It's kind of interesting. So I personally don't have any experience, but I have friends. So, like, algorithms and stuff that needs to be worked on, they send to Russians because they have no money for hardware. So they run old machines. So I have to figure out better algorithms. Here in the States, we're lazy, right? We just buy faster machines. Like, hey, it's faster. Look at that. There, they actually figure out algorithms. I think Swarmcat's does that. I'm positive. And as far as, like, Eastern Europeans, with the whole EU thing, like, the whole normalization, I think the prices have kind of changed that. And, I don't know, with the EU, there's so much taxes and things like that. They're just in a horrible state right now. Yeah.
I'm curious if you were talking about taking a manufacturing approach to software and how that's what they're doing in the end. I'm curious if you think that's like a firmly entrenched value there, if that's something that's going to converge. I can't think of any. It's not really often that people start out thinking of manufacturing and turn into craft. They kind of keep a bit of their mind.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of my coworkers just got back from India. They were there for, I think, 2 weeks or something like that. And, that's what they came back with. And then actually they're the ones that kind of clued me into the fact that there is this big difference of how software is looked at. Why that is, I'm not sure. If it's like that, definitely. I mean, like, two firms I work with are Tata and ThoughtWorks, right? So, you know, Martin Fowler's obviously not thinking, you know, manufacturing. But, I don't know, this is the kind of, this is the best thing that's fit so far for what's going on. Because what I see in the, when I look at the code and when I see what's happening, is just forward progress all the time at no cost, right? So I just did a code review of, I think the change set was 67 lines or something. In 67 lines, I saw a SQL injection, I saw a where clause that had a like in it with also a function to do concatenate or to do a substring that was so bad that it was timing out the database connection. I saw code that was written so that branch statements were actually their own functions. So they would have, like, if I equals 2, return true, else return false, and that was a new method. I saw code that was written that looked like a Rails association proxy, even though Rails has that all built in. And that was in 67 lines of code. And so I think the thing, like, you know, from what I see in the code is just this idea of just to get it done. So I don't know if manufacturing is the best example, but from what they've said, it's actually kind of depressing. Like, if you go to Tata over in India, it's very depressing. So most of the guys that go there don't want to go back. Just a huge room, kind of got cubicles, tables, but they're all in this big giant space working with different, you know, they're each working with different contractors or different companies back in the United States. And so there'd be a conference call, and the phones are really old, and so they gather around this thing. Except it's a big open room like this, right? And there's like 45 conference calls going on. And the phone cuts in and out, so you hear every, like, you know, other sentence. It's pretty horrible. But Tata's not exactly the best choice in the world either. ThoughtWorks isn't quite as bad, but.
What other QA techniques do you use to kind of guarantee the quality buyer is at an acceptable level? I've been working with Tata, and the quality thing is just killing.
Yeah, so that's actually, I mean, the kind of, and actually, in that sense, I think it works better with Java to ensure the quality. Because with Java, you've got nice things like PMD, right? So you can check those things. So with Rails and Ruby, you know, we actually have things like Markov, which will do C0 code coverage, make sure everything to test it. But it doesn't really test that both branches have been executed or things like that. The other thing too is I've written some tools that allow me to check the things. So, and actually Zed Shaw was the one that kind of talked with him, we kind of came up with this idea, more so for me. This idea that every time there's a change set that comes in, I look at it and I've written a program so I can edit it and comment the change set. It's up on a wiki and I send it. So everyone, not wiki, but it's up on this web app. So everyone can see what's going on and see the comments in the code and change set. The best part is when you check in your names next to it, to have this leaderboard. It's called Who's Fucking and Who's Fucked. Because it shows, right, you know, who's writing good code, who's writing bad code. Because not only do I write a comment about the code, but I also give it a flake status, right? Red, this is really bad, like a SQL injection or things like that. And then there's like, you know, yellow or orange. It's like orange. More for like a warning about, you know, maybe you should include this in the next iteration or something like that, or next sprint. And then kind of like a blue, that's just kind of an informative thing. And it doesn't, you know, when I wrote it, I'm like, this is just not going to go good because it's going to create this comment. I mean, I just thought this would be really bad. I think it would be really bad. But then I actually implemented it, and it turned out not to be that at all. So I changed the name of the screen. Because what ended up happening is people loved it, because they actually were able to look and improve. And because what I had done is I had filled this whole mentoring gap that they had had. There is someone now in some place that they could go to have their code looked at, and they could get better and better. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out metrics around, but we want to do something so we can actually track the progress to see how it's getting better, and how it's... I think we can just do it by the number of, you know, red comments versus blue comments over a period of time and graph it. And the idea is hopefully that'll go better. So, I mean, that's one thing that we do locally, trying to do locally as well. But then, you know, continuous integration systems as well. But unfortunately, you know, with Ruby, I should definitely spend some time thinking about trying to figure out to do something like PMD in Java. You guys know what PMD is in Java?
Find bugs is more common.
What's that?
A lot of people don't find bugs.
Oh, okay. So, do something like that in Ruby, except I don't know how you do it in Ruby.
I mean, it's PMD.
You want to explain, John?
Sure. PMD is, and find bugs are tools that actually go through, analyze the source code, and they actually analyze the parse tree and catch common, common problems and bugs that unnecessary code, double check blocking, all that kind of stuff.
So, can we use
some. We'll find some.
I mean, the more automated tools we can put in place, the better. Unfortunately, there's nothing that beats like a trained eye to go through and look at it. And so, what we're trying to do is spend time with tools, trying to, whatever we can do to amplify that mentor. Because the truth is, everyone's interested in learning and being better. And, I mean, the mentors learn stuff too, it's not a one way street.
I just after that, I have a team of 24 programmers in Lahore, Pakistan, and I think I can totally understand what you're saying, and I completely agree. I tried to understand why is it that they have a manufacturing mentality there, whereas here we have the craft concern. And I think from what I have limited experience, about a year I've been running the office over there, is that there's just too many people coming out of college over there studying computer science. You know, I have an ad there in the local newspaper where I get 250, you know, applicants for one of the positions. And way too much production of people who are studying computer science and graduate from college, and not enough mentors and established companies to guide them to show how good software engineering is done. And they have bad examples to follow. So one of the things that I have been successful with is that if you're able to spend the time and train them, and really take the time to guide them how good software engineering is done, you know, you can really get good results. Case in point, I was doing some development, 20 programs doing .NET, and not a single one of them has any idea on how to do command line, you know, app-based development or cruise control and things like that. Mm-hmm. To them, everything is at five. Because they don't compile. And when I tried to explain it to them, they just didn't get it. Week to week, you just prove it to them that it's good for them. So after I sent them a couple of books on how to do all of .NET development without touching the GUI, I mean, besides the IDE.
Right, yeah.
You know, the integration and stuff, they loved it and they're pretty productive. But it takes a lot of time to train them, and that's just because of the mass production and money.
Yeah, and I completely agree. Like, my experience has been, anytime I've offered a help, it's always been accepted without question. And if anything, the next day they call asking for more help. Not because they don't get it, because they just want to, like, okay, what's the next step? So.
What is interesting, and how much of that is motivated by wanting to be able to cross the barrier, right? So that extra thing about making that journey, that's all about efficiency and putting away in the experience. So if you have that mentality, how do you think that translates?
Well, I think for those people, they don't really know what their rates are being and what they're being outsourced to. So to them, you know, cost is not, you know, the programmer doesn't really know what their company is outsourcing to you, or they don't know if I'm giving them, what am I charging my clients or what the costs are. So I was more saying that, you know, people graduate from there, and to them, studying computer science, it's all about ROI. How much salary can I make, and how much, like, for instance, when I talk to my developer there, their most important thing is what is my next raise, and you know, I got my 6 months, my 3 months, and I see, let's talk about work, and they're always motivated about money. And then when I yell at them, they go like, well, you know, have you seen the cost of living here and this and that? I said, you know, I don't have these kind of discussions with my American, programmer. And so I think there's a bunch of multiple things. In Microsoft, for instance, there's so much, the cost of living is going high so fast that these people are more fixated on money and rents and all of that than actual software development.
And I think a lot of companies are starting to do a total cost of ownership calculation now, too. In figuring out that, hey, maybe this poor quality code is actually costing me more in the long term, right? Because if we take the full life cycle of a piece of software, especially in an enterprise, like a startup is like boom, boom, bankrupt. But with like an enterprise, right, you write something, it probably will live well past your prime coding days. I mean, there's a good chance. So when you look at code like that, what becomes really good, what's really important to that kind of code is, good quality, because then it's maintainable, I can extend it, I can add to it, I can, move it out to different servers and upgrade the OS without anything broken.
Yeah.
So when you start taking that larger calculation, it's cheaper. And in fact, I'll get to you in a second. In fact, I just mentioned, ThoughtWorks is having a hell of a time finding guys in India to work for them right now, so much so that they've actually passed on projects, like Ruby on Rails projects, so they can't find the talent. Tata is realizing that's not working either. I think Tata's kind of got this idea, but they don't quite get it. They're trying to open an office in Cleveland, right? Thinking that that'll be better and hire college grads. So they're kind of on the idea, but they all miss this whole like concept of like, I don't know any Rails developers in Cleveland. I mean, they're out there, I know, but they're working for companies like elsewhere, and so it's all the places you can pick. So I think a lot of companies, see this cost and realize that this poor quality is really costing us lots of money. I mean, some of the code that we get, we probably blew any savings we could trying to deploy it on the servers. Yeah.
So you said a lot about how to make more good developers and how to mentor them. Can you say a bit about just the project management aspect of it? Of now you have these developers and you have is it the mentor that are managing the projects, or is there a separation?
No, there's a separation. So the mentors are just kind of focusing on the code and the team in like more of like kind of an architect kind of role. There's not a whole lot of architects in Rails. But then there's a separate that does the project management. And so we've been kind of lucky because, we're doing this small, right, because it's kind of an experiment to see how this goes. Where what we've done right now is we've been using the project managers at the client's company. So, they use Scrum, they've all been trained on Scrum, some of them are even Scrum Masters, so that we just adopt that, and they can kind of run the project and manage it. And so far they've been really happy because they feel like they have control of the whole situation. But I do see like solving the whole project management part is definitely a problem for companies that just want to say, here's the requirements and go. I don't know, I've been lucky to have very interactive clients that kind of want the feedback and make changes. I don't know if it would work if they actually went software manufactured. And I don't know if that would make sense to take that client either. Usually I can always find somebody in some company to tell me what they want, even if it's the end user. But so right now, just kind of wrap up. Rails plus farm servicing, I think, can definitely solve a lot of the problems. My focus is on larger, like Fortune 500 companies that have this huge backlog of our experience with outsourcing, already feel the pain. And then the other thing is my current client has lots of connections with Fortune 500 companies, so it's a good market. And it's a $20 billion market right now. Like, this is from McKinsey's Knowledge Center numbers from 2006 or 5. It's $20 billion in IT outsourced to India. I am not quite at $20 billion. However, I feel that I can get there, you know, pretty fast because I think what we can offer and what the Midwest can do is, you know, phenomenal. And it just really changed the whole game and the whole situation. So if you're interested in giving me some cash to make this happen faster, talk to me. If you're into, you know, some college kids that want some jobs, contact me as well. Thanks.